line. Right,
that was amazing.
That was amazing.
AMD president of everybody. If you could find that, that would be amazing. Yeah, I don't know that you can, but if you could.
They might have censored it because FIFA has that much control over the world because there's just that much money in the world
AMD
right there.
AMD president of everybody.
Shouts to the world of soccer, football. Yes, it was delicious end into Champions League final. Hey, wish there was a World Cup to talk about, y'all. It's hogwash that there's not. That's foot and mouth.
So what is what do we have to look forward to when it comes to
transfer season is going to be happening right now. People are making moves, but even then, a big name has Mbappe is staying put at PSG. Haaland has already made his move over to
Man City.
Yeah. You already got Lewandowski leaving Bayern. You've got Sadio Mane leaving Liverpool for Bayern. He looks like Lewandowski is going to be signing with Barca. That's pretty much your big names in the transfer right now. You're going to have some obviously teams construction teams trying to construct their squad to get the right players in it, but the big names with Mbappe staying put at PSG, that kind of just
put a damper on everything.
Yeah, a little bit, because it was all about him moving.
Yeah,
and he didn't move. Money, baby.
Yep.
Money.
He got paid.
Oil. Oil money. A lot of people are saying oil money is ruining. A lot of oil money is ruining the game of football out there, and how they're controlling it. I mean, I will say, things aren't out of the world. Let's go, please.
All right, enjoy. I got it. Here we go.
I've said I forgive, but I don't forget when it comes to persons and to not to facts. And I have said also yesterday, I have been elected by 133 national associations, but I am the president of everybody.
Wow. 133 associations.
And I am the president of everybody.
And of all of those associations.
And all those associations.
Yeah. That's great.
Oh, man. Sepp Blatter. Well, he's not the president of anymore. But either way.
He is the president of nobody. Right now.
Yes. Yeah.
Man, what a hard fall. What a fall from grace. The president of everybody, the president of nobody.
Dude
still counts.
Like, 60-0 really quick.
I mean, I know I'm part of everybody, but like, was he? I guess he was president of all of us.
He was president of everybody.
He was president of our president. So our president had a president.
You're somebody, and he was the president of everybody.
Yeah. Wow. That's,
there you have it.
Oof. That's tough places, y'all.
Yeah, it is tough.
I didn't realize our president had a president, but apparently it was Sepp Blatter. No. I wonder if the new FIFA president is president of everybody.
Well, he has to declare it.
He has to declare it. That's true. Mm-hmm. If he declares it, then you're it.
Yeah.
So
it's pretty simple.
That's about it right now. Yeah. So one of these days, hopefully I can declare I'm the president of everybody.
I'm the president of everybody.
Until that moment, just hold on, y'all.
All right.
I'll be there.
Hold it on.
Yeah. Okay. That's foot and mouth, guys.
Yes, indeed. Talk about practice. Chico's only locally produced sports talk radio show right here on FM 90.1 KZFR. Want to give a big shout out to you. Big shout out to the crew as well. Derek, Rudy, Brad, I'm Jerome. It's been fun so far. I don't know that we talked about much at all, but I've enjoyed it, so.
Yeah!
There we go, 5:30, baby.
Sorry, it hit 5:34 and I got like, just feel like this is the right time.
All right, perfect. All right, thank you, sir. We want to give a shout out to our friends over at ID International. ID International can provide websites, logos, packaging, show displays, and social media strategies to help your business grow. Visit ID International online. Thank you to ID International. Thank you to Satava Art Glass Studio. And most importantly, thank you to you, our listener, for dealing with our nonsense for the past 5-6 years. But how long have we been doing this show? 16.
Blew that 3-1 lead, so.
So back in
2016.
Yeah. All right, six years.
Yeah, I was going to say, was it 16? I guess.
Yeah.
Because I came on. Because I came on.
Is it 16, 17, or was it 15?
No, I thought 16. It was 15, 16 because.
That's 15, 16.
Yeah, because
so
you guys.
We started in 16 then.
Yeah.
You guys have been doing it for a while when you asked me when I was still in college in 17, so.
Yeah.
All right. Well.
Let's keep it moving, baby. Yeah. Memory lane is closed, all right?
It's been a minute. We haven't done the news in a while, Derek.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Is it my turn right now? Yeah. It's my time to shine.
Do you want me to give you a minute?
I was going to say, this
I'll
is
just
a,
go
yeah.
ahead and filibuster because I got to find the music.
I
don't know if it's just the time. A lot of stuff is just off right now, okay?
A little bit. We're getting used to it right now. Yeah, we are. Kinks are coming out, but don't worry, y'all. News Just give me the drop. I'm ready.
All right, give me it. Well, I'm not.
Okay. Oh, so I should keep filibustering for you then.
I just found it.
There we go. Filibustered filled.
When news breaks in the tri-state area or the world.
Breaking news, breaking news. Derek Isamaki has breaking news.
That is right, y'all. Time for the news.
It's been a while.
Oh,
man.
My goodness. This is backload right now, yeah. Okay? This is all like, right. you haven't done it in a while and it just comes everywhere, okay? All right. So I'm going everywhere right now, guys. I am covering all degrees of all layers right now. All right. So we start off with the good. We give you the good, the bad, and the ugly, okay? That's what we do here, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Now, there's a lot of good to choose from because I've been on a good feels lately, so I have found some great stories. But don't worry. Start off with the good, though. The good. So I don't know about you guys. No, you know what? I take it back. This is not good. I've just kind of realized as I'm going through this story right now, I realize it actually is kind of a fatality of, once again, whiteness. Now, here we go. So it is good in that fashion. So there we go. Yeah. The fragility of whiteness right now. So apparently, people are having problems keeping their burritos held together. Now, I don't know about you. I've never had that problem right now. As a good standing Mexican. Actually, burritos aren't even Mexican food right now.
They're not.
They're
Californian food.
Very Californian food. Derived with Mexican ingredients, obviously.
Yeah, that's correct.
There's maybe two parts in Mexico that do use flour tortillas. But mostly
For other reasons.
Not for burritos. And for the most part, it's corn tortillas everywhere.
Hold on. You had a question. Go ahead.
What? I was going to say, but what do you guys use them for then? For the corn tortillas?
Anything.
Well,
like
corn tortillas are tacos. Yeah. That's your taco. Your small.
Oh, sorry. Flour, I meant. Flour.
A flour tortilla we use like as an...
Enchilada?
No. Kind of like as a spoon or a fork. We rip the tortilla. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The meat, the rice, and the beans, and we make our own little thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And again, like the flour tortilla is not as common in Mexico.
Yes.
It's not as common.
It's corn primarily. So it's luxury to have flour.
It's like a small sect of Mexico.
Gotcha.
You know? It's like Louisiana eating their crawfish, you know?
Okay. Yeah, you know? Gotcha. Yeah. All right. Fair. Question's over.
That being said, people out there having problems with their burritos, and they can't keep them together. That being said, every Mexican knows how to roll a proper burrito, even though they're not ours, okay? We just found out how to do it properly, okay?
Yeah.
Like, as a kid growing up, when we were making that, I always had my mom roll my burrito up because I was terrible at it. Then I finally learned my process because fragile fingers. That being said, they found that way to overcome the inability to roll a proper burrito. Why? By inventing an edible tape. Yeah, that's right. They made a tape.
Taping
the burrito together. And you can eat that tape. You don't have to worry about pulling it off or anything.
Is that like Chipotle or something or what?
This is like a university project that was done. Like Hopkins students over at the Johns Hopkins University
Wow.
Yes.
How about Johns Hopkins? Worry about medical stuff.
Well, this is like their engineering department right now. Yeah.
You're wasting your time on that.
So this is not,
why don't
like,
you engineer a bigger flour tortilla and stop worrying about the tape?
But I'm just going to be saying, they've created edible tape. Right.
Okay.
So maybe it could be used for other things than tortillas, you know, and burritos. I just feel like this has other use. Either way, we have found a way to hold your burritos together.
That's embarrassing, actually.
A little bit. But either way, kind of ingenious, too. Like an edible adhesive, essentially.
Well, catch me putting tape on a burrito, please. Like, push me off the roof. You know, like, kick me down.
Okay.
Like, kill me.
I'm marking it in my calendar right now. Yes. Diary, save this date. And I'm going to be on the lookout, okay? All right. Moving on from edible tape. You ready for it, y'all?
That's wild,
I hope you are. Because I don't know about you guys. We love cars here, right? We're guys. We love cars. You don't have to be a guy to love a car. You just love something that's just raw and intensity right there.
That's what she said.
Thank you. And I don't know about you. You've always fantasized about what you get and what you get. Your best car you get. You probably think, you're splurging a lot, you know, no
Ferrari
matter what.
Ferrari F8, dude, spider, yeah. Let's go.
There we go, okay? That's at least seven figures right there, right?
It's my dream car.
Yeah, you're probably spending that. Now add two more figures to that, okay?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're talking $142 million, in fact, actually.
Hmm?
Yeah, yeah. So most recently, a Mercedes-Benz 1955 SLR Coupe just sold for that price of $142 million, making it the highest automobile to ever be purchased. Highest amount ever paid for an automobile, I should say. That's the proper way to phrase it.
God damn.
Is that not crazy? $142 million. $142 million for one car that probably will never see the light of day.
No, yeah. It's
just sold in the collection.
A showroom in a garage.
Yeah. Never. You do not touch that thing. You don't even look at it. Don't even look at it.
Yeah, you got too much money.
Yeah, you don't even look at that for that type of money. That's something you're just like, I have it in there. You're not going to go see it then.
Yeah.
Okay? Just know it's there.
It's a big Dick Cheney move.
That is a straight up, right? Man, that would be an interesting car to drive, though. That would be intense.
That'd be weird.
I couldn't drive it, actually. I would feel so afraid behind the wheel.
I would ghost ride it.
Don't leave me hanging. There it is. And here it comes, Jerome, ghost riding it down Beverly Hill. Rodeo Drive.
There we go. Yes.
How's everyone is losing their mind.
Yeah.
Now, I will say
slapping Mac Dre.
This severely dwarfs the previous record. Nearly doubles it, in fact. From 2018 and 1963, Ferrari GT40, Ferrari 250 GTO. I apologize. $70 million paid for that one. This doubled that, man.
So damn. Doubled an auction.
Doubled an auction right there. So, hey, apparently, apparently there's a lot of money out there. So, and one guy had it all. Yes.
There's a lot of FU money out there.
And it's all looking me in the face.
Well, I mean, just think about it. If a guy had $1 billion, he only has like $800 million left after that purchase. A little bit over.
Chump change.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Change. He's fine.
Dude's got nothing. Okay, so we move on to greener pastures now. Luckily, over into the Tempe area of...
Arizona.
Thank you. Tempe, Arizona, they have captured the penis man. That is right. The infamous man who has been reported all over the Tempe area of tagging several businesses with penis-shaped graffiti.
Oh, like art. Okay. I thought this was going to get worse.
Yeah, no. Dustin Schomer had quite a fancy. Now, he's saying that he is not alone in his desire to paint phallic-looking objects onto buildings.
Rat.
So keep your eyes out, y'all.
There's more
else. But the thing is that caught my attention on the story is the fact that Dustin Schomer was arrested in his condo by a SWAT team.
Oh.
Damn, I got that serious?
Yeah. Now,
a SWAT team
for a man who tags up businesses with penises.
For a graffiti artist.
Yeah. Graffiti artist, yeah.
That's where our tax money is.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Jesus.
But when you shoot up kids, now we're going to stand back and let it happen.
Yeah, we're going to wait there for an hour.
No. SWAT team for this guy. Now, granted, I know different areas, but still.
Still, it doesn't matter.
Same. I mean, Arizona, Texas, but still. What? A SWAT team for this guy?
Probably hundreds of hours of, investigating, right? Who is this guy? People on roofs.
I get it. We don't need to have that on your businesses right there. That's not fun. Yeah. It shouldn't be tagged up. We don't need that everywhere.
Think about the debrief, though, on this. Of, like, how to insert yourself into this house. That'd be great. Yeah,
this guy is top priority project right now. We need our best minds on it. Yeah. Give me... I'm sorry. We need our best heads on it. Yeah! There we go!
CIA, FBI came in and helped out on the investigation, right?
Oh, wow. Needed. Needed. All right. Members only.
At least law enforcement's doing something out there, huh?
I mean, avert your eyes, everyone.
They're doing, probably playing Halo or something while he's
behind. Right. Most likely, yeah. Probably getting stoned,
Yeah.
He probably thought he was in the game for a second.
He's
like, whoa, we alive.
I won the contest.
Wow. This is our VR. What?
Well, a lot of news to spurge on you guys.
Thank you.
That was
much needed.
Yeah.
I see what you just did there.
You're welcome.
Oh.
Is that the news?
Yes. That's the news.
I'm glad
we did a 12-minute news segment because it's been a while.
I told you, I had a lot of backup.
We had
a lot of backup.
Okay. Speaking of it, it's been a while since we've had our foreign correspondent on the show. So, ladies and gentlemen, making her triumphant return, our foreign correspondent, Erin. Erin, hello.
How's it going, guys?
What up?
What up, what up? Hey, so, we have a lot to get to. So,
like I mentioned to you off air, we're going to do some rapid fire. We have NHL playoffs. Yeah. We have French Open. We have the match. And then we have something special. We have your stadium tour. So where do you want to start? Not the stadium tour. We're going to finish with that. Where would you like to start?
Yeah, I guess we can start with hockey because Colorado is currently playing the Edmonton Oilers. They're up 1-0. Nothing, but we've still got 2 whole periods left to play. It's looking good. They're up 3-0. We've got the Rangers and Tampa Bay in the Eastern Conference. The Rangers won up 2 games. Tampa Bay has won 1. So my prediction is still alive that we can still see Tampa and Colorado in the Stanley Cup Finals, but Tampa's kind of got to get it together.
Yeah, what's going on with Vasilevskiy? He didn't give up any goals. I mean, he gave up, 3 goals in 4 games or something like that to the Panthers, who led the league in goal scoring, and then all of a sudden he's just giving up everything?
Yeah, it's very strange. Very, very strange. But, we'll see. We'll see. But it's very, very bizarre to see them go down 2-0. Yeah, it's never good to do that in the playoffs.
But it is safe to say that the cup is not going back to Canada, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's no way.
We can say that. Okay. Yeah, I'm down. That's good. That's good news right there. Right now, they don't deserve it this year. I'm sorry, Canada. You lost it.
Yeah,
Edmonton 100%. Is what you put up.
Not upset about that.
That's what you put out there. Pathetic. Pathetic Canada. Maple Leafs, you might as well be Oakley's at this point in time, okay? Like, there's nothing sweet coming out of that place, all right? That's all I know. Actually, Poison Ivy, that would be a better one.
Oh, Oakley's. I thought I said Oakley's, like the glasses. Like, what?
No, yeah. Okay. I was trying to think
not helpful at all to anyone, Brad. Thank you. Please continue. Can we give us a catch us up on what's going on with the French Open, if you wouldn't mind?
Yeah, French Open happened this weekend. It was not much of a surprise for the men, obviously. Once you have Rafael Nadal winning it all.
I was saying, how is that? The guy, 13. Yeah. 13 grants French Opens. That's insane.
Yeah.
Isn't it 14?
Yeah. Is it 14?
I thought it was. 14. I'm going to go 14? Back to 14.
14, even more. That's right, 14 for him, 14 for Real Madrid. Insane.
Yeah, 14 versus Casper Ruud of Norway. Like, who knew that Norway had tennis players? I think that's the most surprising. And then for the women, we did have Coco Gauff go to the finals. Unfortunately, she was completely dismantled in 68 minutes versus Iga Świątek of Poland. So a little bit disappointing, but Coco Gauff is still so young. She still has so much potential. She's kind of our only hope in America right now.
I know. What a fall from grace for us, you know?
I mean, yeah, we had Venus, we had Serena, the greatest around.
The time was going to come.
We had Naomi Osaka, but clearly she doesn't want to play tennis. It's like, what?
Well, I think she claims Japan now.
She's Japanese.
Oh, okay. Well, then,
she's not even ours.
Ooh, never mind then.
Yeah, she can fall from grace all I want.
Yeah.
All I care.
She was American, though. She was claiming.
She's dual citizen, but she
claims
like for the Olympics and all that other stuff, she's Japanese.
Japan, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Not welcoming these boys anymore, that's for sure.
All right, Aaron, catch us up on the match. If you missed it, who was participating in it? And just can you give our audience just a little preview of what the match was all about?
Yeah, if you're not watching it, you're not watching it for the golf because it's just not great. It was Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers versus Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen. Josh Allen is a terrible golfer, as it turns out. So if you want to feel good about yourself as a golfer, I suggest that you watch. But what you watch for is the commentary. I mean, the first one, versus Tiger and Phil, it's taken them to get to their stride. There's so much trash talking. It is hilarious. It's like a comedy show. It turned out that, Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady won, but I don't know. Does anyone really care? Not really. You need to watch it. It's just so funny. Charles Barkley should be a stand-up comedian. He is hilarious. He's got great one-liners, great zingers. It's just so much fun to watch.
Yeah, if you've missed it, it is really... I think this relates to the average person more than the avid golf fan. It is just a lot more inviting, and it's not so hoity-toity as the PGA. And yeah, it's like golfing with your buds.
I love that they had fans out there, and they almost died. You know, that was great. Like, I love how there's one guy that's like, they're just peppering people with balls out there.
Yeah.
And they're like totally okay with it. Like, yeah, give it to me, baby. You know, bring on.
That's what I signed up for.
Yeah, rain on me, baby.
Yeah.
Well, you'd imagine you'd be watching and be able to, like, move out of the way. I don't know how people are, like, just not paying attention.
Okay, Brett, have you ever played golf before?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, okay, you're not seeing one of those things come at you.
Yes, yes, I have. I stand in front of my buddies, and I watch it go past me, or I watch it and it move.
I'm just saying, if you're
away
in the crowd, maybe you don't see the ball's flight at all. You're far away from the tee where it is. You're not right behind him. You're in the crowd where it lands. You don't always see it. I mean, I'm not trying to like give the guy credit. I still want to make fun of him because he got hit with a Josh Allen golf ball.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're trying to think it's a lot easier than it is.
It's as easy as I'm saying it is.
Okay, all right.
All right, moving on. Aaron, you once again this year, you and your husband Nate decided to go on a bit of a road trip here and hit some more ballparks this summer. Tell us where you went and what your favorite ballpark was and what your favorite food was.
Oh, well, food, obviously cheesesteaks. We went to Philadelphia. We started in Maryland. We went to go see the Yankees at the Camden Yards. Beautiful stadium. Definitely recommend. I heard that from a lot of, you know, baseball fans. You know, I tell them that what we like to do. And everyone said, go to Camden Yards. They're 100% right. But it was incredibly embarrassing. There were way more Yankee fans there than Oriole fans. Shameful, just absolutely shameful. The crowd was so loud for the Yankees, but we did get to see a walk-off, and the Orioles won, which was very exciting. Then we went to Philadelphia. We got to see the Dodgers play. 10 out of 10, cannot recommend it enough. Go to another stadium to see your team play. Philadelphia was a lot of fun because they're a baseball town, you know, so the stadium was packed. You know, there were definitely Dodger fans there. The second game, we felt really at home. We saw a bunch of my people. That would be Mexicans, probably. I think they were Mexican. Almost get into a fight. It was a group of five guys.
Hold on.
They were
hold
friends
on real
they
quick.
Came together.
There's Mexicans in Philadelphia, huh?
Apparently. I did not know this.
Me
and
either.
So
and they always got in fights?
My people.
Yeah, well, those
there
are
we
Mexicans.
There
we go.
Sure.
Viva la raza. Let's
I would
go.
Say that's, that's, that feels like home right there, 100%. Right.
Sorry,
yeah.
Continue.
It was home, and it was hilarious. They were friends. It was these five guys. They came together at the start of the game. They're having a great time. They're getting beers. At the end, security was coming up and was like about to throw them out. It was phenomenal.
That's going
to
be me and Derek this weekend because we're going to Giants Dodgers on Saturday. So I can't not wait for security to break us up.
I mean, we have never gotten into a fight at a game, but you never know.
No.
You never know.
And it's also really early in the season.
It is, yes.
We're no longer friends over game 40. The regular season. All right, sorry to interrupt. So cheesesteaks were the best food. What was the best stadium?
I'm going to have to go with Pittsburgh. I have just always really wanted to go there, so I'm slightly biased. But the last stadium we went to was PNC Park. It's right on the river. They've got these bridges. They were sort of covered up, but it was like beautiful. The stadium is recently built, like I said, right on the river. The views are gorgeous. The stadium, I mean, it was really a beautiful stadium. It's kind of sad, though. They're not a baseball town. We got incredible seats for like no money, and nobody was there. Nobody showed up. So it was a little disappointing, but a beautiful, beautiful stadium. I would, if you're going to go somewhere, I would recommend it over going to Camden Yards.
That's a great call. We're going to have to sometime over the summer, as things slow down, we got to do a whole episode on your journey. Cause how many stadiums have you been to now?
It's upwards of 15 together.
Damn.
And I think, you know, he's gone to some that I haven't gone to and vice versa.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I mean, I would love that for sure.
All right. We got to make it happen. Excellent as always, Aaron. Thank you.
Sounds good. Talk to you later, guys.
Later. All right. Well, Aaron, excellent as always, like I just said. And we got to do that episode.
No doubt. Yeah.
She's been doing that the last couple summers with Nate and just seems like an absolute blast.
I'm just counting.
So I'm nowhere near that. I'm not in double digits, that's for sure.
But you are about to leave.
Yes, I am.
Actually,
It's been real.
I know. All right, y'all.
Thank you.
Check you later.
All right. We still have a decent amount of stuff to get to. We're going to talk baseball. Real quick, Rudy, can you give us our picks with no drop?
No drop.
All right. Give me a second.
Rudy, thank you.
Rudy.
All right, boys, your boy was down big.
Down bad.
Down real bad. My issue was I was betting on hockey. I never do. Oh, yeah, I forgot to thank Aaron for losing all my money on the app. Anywho, long story short, it's a new week. The Warriors came back for me last night.
Yes, sir.
Baby Jesus, because I was going to go to Russia. I was going to go to Mexico because I wasn't going to pay my bookie the amount of money I was down.
I feel like Russia might not be the move right now.
It's okay, dude. They'll open the doors for me. It's all good. Anywho, long story short, I got, yes, that's right, Boston, Wednesday night, -3 at home. They're going to, I don't think they're going to roll, but they're going to beat them by at least 5 or 6 points.
Okay.
And then I got the Giants over the Rockies starting tomorrow on a 3-game series. I'm going to bet the money line on every single of those games. So those are
you also betting the series?
No.
Okay.
I'm going to bet them individually.
Okay.
So
just want to double check.
Yes. So Boston -3.5 Wednesday starting tomorrow. Giants over the Rockies at home. And we'll see how I feel about the Dodger series this weekend because it's always a dogfight between them. And I don't like losing money. I like making money. So let's make that money, boys. Let's go.
Let's get it. Brad, you had something staying with baseball. You had something North State?
I have a North State update. Last year, I said it, and the beginning of this year, or into last year, beginning of this year, I said it, Luke Barker was going to make the MLB this year. And you know what, guys? He made his first appearance. He went 17 games in the minors, had a 4-0 record, 3.79 ERA, comes up to the majors, plays against the Padres. 2 innings, 1 strikeout, 6 up, 6 down. Luke Barker, welcome to the show. I'm excited to see it. Luke Barker, number 49 for the Milwaukee Brewers. Chico local, okay. Good to see it. Oh, yeah, good to see it.
Nice.
So, congratulations, Luke.
That's awesome.
I mean, it went to Chico State, played here, helped as a pitching coach for the Chico Heat when he could, and now he's in the show. Good for him. Good for him. So hopefully he'll stay there. I mean, it would shock me because of his progression in the minors and his show the other day. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Let's see here. You know, I have a quick grinds my gears. Can I get to it?
Yeah.
You know what really grinds my gears?
Not very loud. Let's do it one more time.
You know what really grinds my gears?
Still not very loud.
Jeez, I'm all the way up here.
Oh, I'm not. My bad.
Yeah.
You know what really grinds my gears?
Better.
Traffic in Chico during the summer. Once upon a time, all you SOBs left town. The hell y'all doing here? Leave!
People are still here?
People are here still.
Why?
I don't know. I usually, on Mondays, I park right in front of B Street before we come to do the show. There's no parking in front of B Street. What are y'all doing here? It's hot. Leave.
I got one.
All right.
You know what really grinds my gears?
People that don't let me back into a business with my semi-truck, give me, like, legit 15 seconds, and I'll be out of your way. But no, you have to ruin it for everybody else and make me wait another 3 to 4 minutes because you were impatient and almost caused a wreck. You played yourself.
Nice.
Yeah, super relatable to most people.
It's a grinds my gears to me.
All right, we got one more. Hold on.
You know what really grinds my gears?
Girls that hold their stomach when they're pregnant in pictures. Like, dude, we know you're pregnant. Right? Like, we could see it right there. You don't need to be holding your stomach. We know, okay?
Oh, my God. I laughed because I just saw that. I was like, yeah, we got it, dude.
Give me a pretty good.
You know what really grinds my gears?
A pretty good. A pretty good. Not a grinds my gears.
I don't have it.
Oh, darn it. All right. You know what's pretty good? The guys that imitate that with the beer bellies.
Yeah,
that's pretty, pretty good. Yeah, I like it. It's comical. Yeah. It's comical.
Yeah, we need to go back to 5:30s for Brad. All right, that's been real, everybody. We'll catch you later. You could check out what's after us. Counterspin, because it used to be before us. Now it's after us. You're welcome, America.
I don't like this.
Game over, man. Game over.
Next up in a little bit, LeShow. Here it is.
In a half hour.
In a half hour, yes.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, AP's May 23rd headline told readers, Supreme Court rules against inmates in right to counsel case. Those who pushed past the idea of being interested in inmates were favored with a lead that explained that, quote, the Supreme Court ruled along ideological lines Monday against two Arizona death row inmates who had argued that their lawyers did a poor job representing them in state court, close quote. For which many readers might be excused for saying, essentially, boo-hoo. People who the system has determined guilty are upset with that fact. Next story, please. Had AP headlined its story, Supreme Court rules evidence of innocence is not enough to avoid execution by the state, perhaps more readers might have read past the big letters. The truth is, while alternative and legal and human rights-oriented media are up in arms about the Supreme Court's ruling in Shin versus Martinez-Ramirez, corporate news media don't seem to think there's much to see there, which has everything to do with their relative disinterest in the human rights of humans at the wrong end of the criminal justice system, and how willing they are to allow any degree of complexity to obscure important truths and to blur outrage. We'll talk about this new Supreme Court ruling about the so-called sanctity of life with Liliana Segura, reporter for The Intercept. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. The country's centrist corporate media have decided what this year's primaries are mainly about. Donald Trump. In the wake of an attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election and continued efforts by the Republican Party to undermine democratic processes, corporate media remain fixated on Trump's role in the party, seeing the 2022 primaries as a series of referenda on Trump and his role as kingmaker. As Julie Holler writes for Affair.org, the focus on Trump obscures the even more important story that Trump represents, the GOP assault on democracy, which is being carried out only marginally less aggressively by many of those defeating Trump. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp is a great example of this. After the state primaries, most corporate media made their lead story the losses of Trump-backed candidates, in particular Kemp and Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who both played very public roles in refusing to bow to Trump's demand to find votes for him in Georgia in 2020. The Washington Post declared, Kemp, Raffensperger win in blow to Trump and his false election claims. A New York Times subhead read, the victories in Georgia by Governor Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, handed the former president his biggest primary season setback so far. Reuters boiled it down with a takeaway subhead, Trump takes lumps.
Well, these are stories that centrist media like to tell, that voters are sensibly rejecting extremists from their party, so moderate candidates are taking the right path. They tell this story again and again, including with Democrats, where they say the move to the center stories encourage the primary to reject progressive candidates. The problem here is that Kemp and Raffensperger are not moderate, except in comparison to Trump. So painting the story as one about Trump obscures the anti-democratic nature of those who defeated his hand-picked candidates. The Boston Globe demonstrated that you can explain this contradiction. They had a headline, May 24th, Kemp cruises to victory in Georgia, dealing blow to Trump, but not his voter fraud lies, in which the Globe's Jess Bidgood reported that, quote, even though he stood up to Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election, Kemp found other ways to assuage the GOP's base's unfounded doubts about the issue. He signed a voting bill that added new hurdles to absentee voting and handed some election oversight power to the Republican-controlled legislature. He spoke of election integrity everywhere he went, while Raffensperger leaned into the issue as well. Close quote. As Holler further noted, as Georgia Secretary of State, Kemp for years vigorously promoted false election fraud stories, and he made Georgia a hotspot for undermining voting rights. He aggressively investigated groups that helped register voters of color, including a criminal investigation into Stacey Abrams' New Georgia Project, which ultimately uncovered no wrongdoing. Kemp oversaw the rejection of tens of thousands of voter registrations on technicalities like missing accents or typos, and he improperly purged hundreds of thousands of voters from the rolls prior to the 2018 election, disproportionately impacting voters of color. And then he refused to recuse himself from overseeing his own race for governor against Stacey Abrams. None of Kemp's history as anti-voting rights Secretary of State was mentioned in any of the post-election coverage that FAIR's Julie Holler surveyed. Like Kemp, Raffensperger was an early supporter of Trump, who pushed election fraud stories and voter suppression tactics. Like Kemp, he launched voter fraud investigations into progressive voter registration groups, and he oversaw the purge of nearly 200,000 voters, mostly people of color, from the rolls before the 2020 election. During his reelection campaign, Raffensperger went on national television to push for a constitutional amendment prohibiting non-citizens from voting in any elections, as well as to praise photo ID requirements for voting and to oppose same-day voter registration. He's also called for an expansion of law enforcement presence at polling sites. In their obsession with Trump's win-loss record and their desperate search for moderate Republicans, corporate journalists are whitewashing GOP candidates who paved the way for Trumpism and who ultimately seek the same ends, minority rule, maybe by only slightly different means. So this is shallow, simplistic reporting that would serve the public poorly at any time. But at a moment where we are vigorously fighting to salvage a democratic project, this kind of reporting just serves as further indication that corporate media aren't the place for the kind of honest conversations that we need to have. You're listening to Counterspin. It's brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Innocence is not enough. Our words to chill your heart. That's the language Arizona state prosecutors used as a reason not to revisit the conviction of Barry Lee Jones after the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals determined that Jones had not received effective counsel. and that if he had, his jury would likely not have convicted him of the murder of his girlfriend's four-year-old daughter. And the Supreme Court agreed this week. They voted 6-3 in a case called Shin versus Martinez-Ramirez that incarcerated people, including death row inmates like Jones, have no right to bring new evidence in their claims of ineffective lawyering in federal court, even if that evidence would show they'd committed no crime. Sonia Sotomayor called the ruling perverse and illogical. Experts like Christina Swarns, head of Innocence Project, noted that ineffective assistance of counsel is a leading cause of wrongful conviction. And it was lost on few that the same judges who insist that the sanctity of life demands that fetuses mean more than the people carrying them show no evidence of such interest here. Pretty much any deep account of this court ruling will cite the work of our guest. She's been reporting criminal justice and the death penalty for many years and was writing about Jones's case in particular back in 2017. Liliana Segura is a reporter at The Intercept. She joins us by phone from Nashville. Welcome back to Counterspin, Liliana Segura.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can I ask you to talk us through the key points of the case against Barry Lee Jones and the issues with that case such that it wound up at the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. So Barry Jones was convicted in 1995 of the rape and murder of his girlfriend's four-year-old daughter, Rachel Gray. Rachel was living with her siblings and their mom in Jones's trailer at a place called the Desert Vista Trailer Park in Tucson. This was a place where there was pretty pervasive poverty and drug use and a lot of folks sort of living on the margins. And what happened was that on the morning of May 2nd, 1994, Rachel was found unresponsive in her bed at Jones's home. And Jones and Rachel's mom rushed her to the hospital where she was declared dead on arrival. There were some disturbing signs of injury all over her body, but crucially, an autopsy, which was not performed until the following day, found that Rachel had died from an apparent blow to her abdomen that had torn part of her small intestine. And this led to a fatal injury called peritonitis. But also crucially, from the start, the investigating detective with the Pima County Sheriff's Department never looked into exactly how Rachel had sustained this injury. There was no real investigation of that key medical evidence. Instead, before they even knew how this little girl died, she turned her sights directly onto Barry Jones. So if you fast forward, you know, Jones is tried in 1995. There should have been a lot of evidence that his trial lawyers could have brought to cast doubt on his guilt in this case. There was really no physical evidence or very little physical evidence linking him to Rachel's injuries. And especially important was the fact that the case was really based on circumstantial evidence, that a sort of very narrow time frame on the day before this little girl died where she had been spotted with Jones by people around the trailer park. And so the state presented a case in which her fatal injury had been inflicted within this very narrow time frame the day before she died. Now, Jones's trial attorneys should have investigated this. They should have talked to somebody who could consider the medical evidence to see if this held up. But instead, they never did that. And in fact, they really failed to investigate the case at all. And instead, when it came time for them to present evidence, they put on a single witness at the guilt phase. And that was Jones's 12-year-old daughter, Brandy. That was their only witness. So Jones's jury finds him guilty and a judge sentences him to death.
And then there's an appeal, which, again, there's another problem. That's part of the issue here, is there's a couple of layers of ineffective lawyering right before it makes it up to the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right. So in our system, at least in theory, after you are convicted and certainly sentenced to death, you have the right to bring forward an appeal, and crucially, you have a right to bring evidence that your trial attorneys failed you, that they provided ineffective assistance of counsel. This is a really important avenue for relief, especially for people on death row, because those are the kinds of, it's that kind of evidence that can lead to a conviction being overturned or somebody being exonerated. The problem is that there's absolutely no guarantee that your lawyer who handles that appeal is going to do what they need to do. And in Barry Jones's case, this is precisely what happened. He was represented at state post-conviction by a man who basically replicated the same mistakes his trial lawyers made. He did not investigate the medical evidence underpinning the state's case against Barry Jones. And what's so significant about that failure is that because of the way that our system is set up and these incredibly onerous procedural barriers that exist once a case is at that stage, once a post-conviction attorney fails to bring forward that evidence of bad lawyering, you can never bring that evidence into federal court at a later stage. It's basically barred. And so that's what happens to Barry Jones until, and this is what leads us to the Supreme Court situation. In 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a really important ruling in a different Arizona case. And this ruling was called Martinez versus Ryan. Mm-hmm. And in this ruling, in a 7-2 decision, the court held that essentially, if you had a situation, as with Barry Jones' case, where your trial lawyers failed you, and then your state post-conviction lawyers also failed you, that you should actually have a shot to bring forward this claim, to bring forward a potentially evidence, to prove that you received ineffective assistance at trial. This was a really big deal when it came down in 2012, but it was meant to be a narrow remedy, a sort of safety valve, precisely to avoid miscarriages of justice and to ensure that people on death row and people incarcerated are able to vindicate their Sixth Amendment rights. And so this ruling was also really noteworthy because Chief Justice Roberts was in the majority. Mm-hmm. So was Sam Alito, it bears mentioning. So right. 7-2, this is 2012. And it's ultimately that decision that allows Barry Jones to bring forward all this evidence that should have been brought forward in 1995 at his trial.
Thank you very much. What this latest, Shin versus Martinez-Ramirez, seems to be gutting that Martinez ruling that you're talking about. It's this weird thing, and folks can learn more about it. But as I understand it, writing for the majority, Clarence Thomas is saying you can still bring your case about having ineffective counsel to federal court. You just can't introduce any new evidence, you know, which presumably would be the stuff, as you're just explaining, that your ineffective counsel left out. So this, I've heard this new ruling described as hollowing out Martinez without actually explicitly overturning it, but still taking all the meaning out of it.
That's precisely right. And it really bears mentioning that, first of all, that Clarence Thomas was in the minority in Martinez. So, you know, right. He never agreed with this decision to begin with. But, you know, all of this sounds bad, but it's sort of theoretical until you consider what this looked like, for example, in Barry Jones's case. What this means is that, as I said, in 2012, Barry Jones gets this sort of new door to be able to present his evidence. He finally is able to do that at an evidentiary hearing in federal court in 2017. I attended part of this hearing. This was the start of my reporting. And it's at that hearing that Barry Jones' lawyers present just an incredible wealth of evidence pointing to his innocence. But, you know, sort of technically what they needed to show was ineffective assistance of counsel. But it really just dismantled the entire case against Barry Jones. And it was stunning to watch the judge presiding over this. You know, at times he would question law enforcement who took the stand saying, well, didn't you consider this? Or why didn't you consider any other suspects? You know, the case really sort of fell apart. And in 2018, this federal judge overturned Barry Jones's conviction and said that but for the failures of his defense attorneys, he would not have been convicted by a jury. And he ordered a new trial. He said, essentially, the state of Arizona, you have to release or retry Barry Jones. And instead, the state of Arizona appealed and appealed and appealed, went to the Ninth Circuit, lost there, went back to the Ninth Circuit, lost there again. But then you get the Supreme Court, and they took their shot, and they got lucky because now we have this conservative supermajority at the Supreme Court that was willing to listen to their argument.
And to say, as Thomas said, intervention, he describes, in other words, introducing the information that can prove or illustrate that this person may not have committed this crime or did not commit this crime. Intervention is an affront to the state and its citizens who returned a verdict of guilt after considering the evidence before them. In other words, states' rights? Is that what we're talking about here? It's a process question, and it's insulting for the federal court to intervene in this case. That seems to be the load-bearing idea in Thomas's opinion.
Exactly. And this goes back to a long argument on the right about basically insisting that federal courts really have no business messing with the outcomes in state proceedings. And, you know, this long precedes Barry Jones's case, but it's really disturbing to see it in this way. It's also that particular line that you mentioned was especially ironic to me because as part of my reporting, I got in touch with some of the jurors involved in Barry Jones's case who expressed serious misgivings about this whole situation, and one in particular came to believe that Barry Jones is absolutely innocent, and she died in the past couple of years. But in our correspondence and in our interview, I mean, she was just really tormented by her role in helping send Barry Jones to die. So this idea that it's an affront to the citizens who returned this verdict is just so dishonest.
Yeah. Well, I want to add something here because details matter very much, of course, and I think at the same time they can also fill this sort of human need to find exceptions, to find a reason this would never happen to you, to find a way that this makes sense, even though it doesn't really make sense, because system failure, I think, is just hard for our brains to grasp, you know, and so in some sense, details can fight with principle, you know. And with that in mind, Ramirez, there's a reason that Ramirez appears in this case name, and the Ramirez case is different. It's not about innocence, but it's still about inadequate counsel, and it's still about federal involvement showing multiple failures that had happened at the state level. Can you just tell us quickly why the Ramirez case fits here?
Yeah, so, and I'm glad you bring this up because this is a question of innocence, but Ramirez's case is a lot more difficult for a lot of people to express concern about, but it should be no less disturbing in terms of the implications of this ruling. You know, Ramirez, and I should say I have not reported on his case, but the basics are that, you know, he was convicted of murdering his girlfriend and her teenage daughter in 1989. He did not have an innocence claim, but he did have, I understand, significant mental impairments and a long history of childhood trauma, abuse, and neglect. All of these things are very common among people who end up on death row. And Ramirez's lead trial attorney had never handled a death penalty case, did not investigate any of this evidence. Right. And as with Jones, his post-conviction lawyer essentially failed to do the same. And so it makes its way through the courts, but essentially what happens is that there's a finding in federal court that he's entitled to an evidentiary hearing in light of Martinez in order to bring forward this evidence, which this is the kind of evidence that can also help a person get off of death row because, you know, ostensibly, we're not supposed to execute people where there should have been a significant finding of childhood trauma, abuse, and neglect that could have come out at trial during the course of what's called mitigation. Essentially, if there had been evidence that jurors had heard that might have moved them to vote differently, that should have come out. Same thing with intellectual disabilities and other kinds of mental problems. Again, because these are such common characteristics of death penalty cases, Ramirez in many ways represents a lot of the same stakes that men and women on death row have and that Martinez should have really allowed them to get back into court to present these findings. And instead, as with Jones, you know, the court said, you know what, none of that matters. And if the evidentiary hearing already happened, it's too bad. None of it counts.
Ramirez's lawyer said that she wasn't prepared to handle the representation of someone as mentally disturbed as he was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think just as lay people, we think that should have meaning, you know. It's hard not to read something into the careful carelessness of this ruling. You know, it looks like emphasis on procedure over people, but it seems really like emphasis on some people over others, you know. Shoring up state power helps certain kinds of people. And it's hard to avoid the idea that there's a sense that the people who are being harmed here are just of the harmable class, you know, and that there's some reason that we shouldn't care about them, you know. And I think for many people, thinking about people ends once you say the words death row. There's a sense that they've been through all the process, they've been found guilty, they must be guilty of something, and you've been working on that story and those people for a long time. I just think that there can never be enough reporting on the realities of the death penalty and the people that are involved there, because I think for a lot of folks, it's a thought stopper.
Thank you for saying that. And you know, one thing that's sort of surreal about this whole situation, in most cases like this, by the time a case gets to the Supreme Court, a lot of these issues become abstractions. You know, it's very rare that we know the story behind the people who appear in these court case names, you know. And in Barry Jones's case, I never would have predicted that this would have ended up making it all the way to the Supreme Court. But it shows the difference that this kind of storytelling can make when you can say, this is a human being, and here are the people in his life who knew him and who remember this and who could have brought forward evidence and continue to speak out about the problems in this case. So I've been fortunate to be in a position to sort of correct parts of the record. Unfortunately, in terms of the Supreme Court and the federal court, that road has really come to an end for Barry Jones for the moment.
Well, let me just ask you finally, I've seen a few things go to Congress. What do you see as ways forward here, along with continued reporting such as you're doing?
That's sort of what I'm figuring out now. You know, in terms of Congress, well, I don't have a whole lot of hope, but right. I will say that this has sparked yet another round of discussion about this horrible 1990s-era law called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which was essentially weaponized in this case to deny relief, as it's been denied to many, many people on death row. This law is insidious. It's destructive. It really should be repealed. That's something that is sort of an evergreen subject among people who know this issue. And more, you know, in terms of Barry Jones's case, my next steps are essentially to sort of see what remaining avenues there are for him to bring possibly an actual innocence claim in state court. Because otherwise, you know, we're talking at a time when Arizona has restarted executions after 8 years. And there's a very real danger that Barry Jones could, in the not too distant future, end up with an execution date. So I think publicizing this case, especially at the local level in Pima County, is going to be very important. And finally, there is a conviction and sentencing integrity unit in Pima County that, at least in theory, should be looking at this case. And up until now, they haven't. I'm really hoping to see if that's a possibility going forward, because they really should be looking at it.
Well, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Liliana Segura. Find her work at TheIntercept.com on this case and many other issues. Liliana Segura, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much again.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. That's also the place to find previous shows and transcripts of Counterspin. It's also the place to show support for the show if you are so inclined. Counterspin is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's no news to those who've been paying attention to the news, which is no news, that Once again, folks up in Washington, D.C., at least some, are trying to find a way to make a deal with the Republicans on Capitol Hill to do something about guns in America. If you don't know why, well, go watch the news. And the consensus seems to be, once again, that there's no deal available. I'm not so sure. I think if the president proposed this, that the prevalence of guns in America was to be promoted as an advantage rather than as some sort of problem, we could probably recruit some, call them gun tourists from overseas who, you know, feel kind of restricted by the restrictions in their home countries. And as they arrive in immigration centers, somehow